This podcast is made possible through listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. And the Florence County Museum, presenting Kindred Spirit, The Personal Worlds of William H. Johnson, exploring the painter's artistic evolution and journey of self-discovery from rural South Carolina to Europe and New York, flocomuseum.org. And Meadow Garden, home of George Walton, one of the youngest signers of the Declaration of Independence. Open for tours Monday through Friday, 10 to 4. Learn more at historicmeadowgarden.org and visit augusta.com.
From South Carolina Public Radio, this is Walter Edgar's Journal. I'm Walter Edgar, welcoming you to our podcast series about South Carolina culture and history with a nod to all things Southern. Today, Alfred Turner and I will be talking with Benjamin Franklin V, author of The Miraculous Art of Jazz.
In this book, Franklin has gathered reviews of hundreds of recordings written over his 40-year career as a jazz writer.
Conveying just the right emotion, his prose brings all the moods of jazz to life, and he joins us today to talk about the history of jazz and his love for this most American art form. With me in the studio today is Ben Franklin, retired English professor from the University of South Carolina, and we'll be talking about his latest book, The Miraculous Art of Jazz, One Writer's Reviews. Ben, it is great to have you back with us on the Journal.
Walter, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, most people, at least in Columbia, know of you as this wonderful English professor. They don't know that for a half century, you have been an international critic of jazz published literally around the world. How did all that happen with a boy growing up in Columbus, Ohio, which one doesn't think of as a jazz town?
Well, there's no easy answer to that, although I could say that Columbus is the birthplace of Roland Kirk, of Harry Sweets Edison, and Nancy Wilson is not far from there. So there was something of a scene there, although I can't say really what struck my fancy about it. As time passed, something about it just struck me. I don't know what it was. I can't really explain it, but it just grabbed me. And I started listening to music intently. One thing led to another. And finally, I got to the point where I said to myself, you know, I'm beginning to know something about this music that I like so very much. And over time, I began wanting to express my opinions about it. I was an undergrad at Ohio State University, taking a class, as many students did, in music appreciation. We had a big lecture section, as you have given in history and I have given in English, and we broke down into small groups to have more individualized instructions, typically with graduate students teaching those. And I said to my teacher, a woman, I'm interested in this thing called jazz. I would like to express myself about it. How do I go about doing that? And she didn't have a clue, because what we were studying was classical music, and what I was proposing was something more or less heretical within that context. They didn't care about that, but I did. And one thing led to another, and finally I amassed a pretty decent record collection. I began to know something about what I was really talking or that interested me. And finally, I decided that I would take a leap and write a review of a recording that very much appealed to me, one by Charlie Parker, and send it off to a respected jazz periodical, which I did. It was named Coda, published in Toronto, Canada. The editors, Bill Smith and John Norris, accepted that, and that was the beginning of my writing career about jazz. One thing led to another. People got to know my name. Musicians began sending me records. Just one thing led to another, and here I am.
That first review was in 1973, and by 1977, you were here in Columbia, and you were doing a show called Jazz in Retrospect on what we then called South Carolina Educational Radio.
Yeah, that happened because I had taught before coming to USC at the University of Michigan, where I was a pretty good friend of the director of broadcasting there named Hazen Schumacher, who had a program called Jazz Revisited, in which he had a half-hour weekly program devoted to music, jazz music, up to and including 1947. And I began thinking, well, 1947 is nice, but there's a lot that's happened in jazz since then, and it's ongoing. So I thought, why not piggyback on what he did and pick it up, basically, with the bebop era around 1945, and take it up to the present. I pitched it to the music director at WUSC, which is the student station. And they accepted that. So I began doing that program there on a local, I think it was like 10-watt station or something then. I think it's enhanced its power since then, but then I think it was something like 10 watts. And maybe after 6 months there, somehow or other, somebody at WLTR, the local NPR outlet here in Columbia, learned about it and asked me if I would be interested in doing it here, to go throughout the state on that network that you identified. And I said, heck yes, I'll be happy to do that. One of the problems I had was that I am not a technician. I could not work the board, as they say, while doing that show, so I relied on somebody else to do that. First, a student named Andy Ellis at WUSC, and then a colleague in the journalism department at USC named Jay Latham. So every show I did on both those networks, first Andy Ellis and then Jay Latham, worked the board and permitted me to do what I wanted to do. So I am deeply indebted to them.
And I have to tell you, a very young Alfred Turner used to run Jazz in Retrospect. On Sunday nights, the little 7-inch reel of tape would be there, and it would be sitting on the shelf somewhere close to Jazz Revisited by Mr. Schumacher, was it?
Yes, Hazen Schumacher.
Hazen Schumacher. And I will confess this now for the first time in public. Once or twice, I would get them mixed up and run them out of order. But once I got the title straight in my head, everything was fine. But between the two of you, I got an education. It was a really great span of time. And I am personally so glad you were doing that show, because I went on to become a fan of bebop.
Well, thank you for saying so, yeah. Alfred.
Okay. I think when you talked about picking up jazz with bebop, growing up on the Gulf Coast, when I thought about jazz, I thought about New Orleans and obviously things prior to 1947. But there are many different versions of jazz, as you point out. You talk about modern jazz. You talk about Pacific Coast jazz. Explain to our listeners the evolution of jazz as you have looked at it in retrospect.
Well, I'm not sure that anyone really can do that. It is kind of an evolution, obviously. Some people call the various schools of jazz revolution rather than evolution. But I don't know. It goes way back beyond what we call jazz, I guess, into ragtime and even before that into field hollers and stuff from going back into slavery and all of that. It's a long, convoluted trip from where it began, whenever that was, up to the present. But there's traditional jazz, which is typically Dixieland, but it was not all that. You go back to New Orleans, where all this music presumably began that we call jazz, and there was this little child who was really a waif named Louis Armstrong walking the streets of New Orleans, didn't have any education, yet he picked up that trumpet and a cornet and just revolutionized music. That led in time to what might be called the swing era, and that leads to modern jazz, bebop, cool jazz, hard bop, the new thing, bossa nova. It just evolved. Life changes. Music changes.
Well, one thing I would like to mention about your book, and it's, I should have said it right off the bat, because a good book or a great book has an index. This is a super great book because you've got an incredible index. It makes what you've got accessible to a novice like me. You've got an index of recording artists. You've got an index of tunes. And that's what I'd like to get into now, is because what some people out there might, our listeners might think of traditional tune, like you growing up hearing Bing Crosby, "I'm an Old Cowhand," which was also recorded by Gene Autry and all the
sure.
old cow. As a jazz tune, "Jingle Bells," "I Left My Heart in San Francisco." I can remember, for example, I think we talked about this earlier, "Patricia" as an instrumental. I can remember that in the 1950s. And that, I guess, the original recording was a jazz tune?
No.
This was done on an organ, I think.
Let me clarify something. The "Patricia" in the book that you have before you
yeah.
was not the Perez Prado mambo that was popular in the 50s. It was an original tune by Art Pepper, named for his daughter.
Oh.
It was not the one that everyone knows,
okay.
recorded for RCA. But the point you're making is that what is the source of jazz? Anything. One of the least likely tunes ever for a jazz interpretation would be "My Favorite Things." Yet somebody like John Coltrane comes along and uses that, and that became one of his signature tunes. You never know what will inspire creativity, and that's an example of it.
Bobby Darin's recording, originally of "Mack the Knight," but that was then later a jazz tune.
Oh, yeah. Ella Fitzgerald, famously. Yeah.
Yeah. I think in terms of Southern historian looking back, I always associated jazz and the blues with protest, anguish. And I only remembered picking up out of your index three or four tunes that were specifically dealing with the civil rights movement. Emmett Till, Defiant Fearless, The Freedom Riders Ride, Martin Luther King Jr., Memphis, The Prophecy, and Rosa Parks and the Montgomery Bus Boycott.
Yeah, those are all compositions and performances by the trumpeter Wadada Leo Smith. But there are others. I'm not sure they're in that book. But a pianist such as Rand Blake, for example, recorded the old tune "Chicago" in 1968 or 69. And if you remember the Democratic Convention of 1968, mm-hmm. it was chaos. Mm-hmm. And that is the way he performs that old tune "Chicago" as chaos. Yeah. So there are numerous examples of that. Yes.
I think the most unusual review you have is one that includes bagpipes.
Rufus Harley, yes. Yeah, not a likely instrument in jazz.
I would like to have heard that because...
yeah, but on that point, I mean, almost everything that I write about there and that anybody writes about when it comes to music is available online. You just go to youtube.com and key in Rufus Harley, and there you'll find it.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit closer to home, performer that most folks in this region recognize, Drink Small. And let's talk a little bit about him.
Well, he is perhaps the last living practitioner of what is called the Piedmont Blues. He's still among us, fortunately, and I believe still performing. But he has been a local celebrity, I guess one could say, for at least as long as I've been in Columbia, which is from the mid-1970s. He is totally admirable in my estimation. He can really pick. He considers himself also a humorist, if you've heard him. And he is kind of funny, actually. But he is the last of that tradition.
Well, I think one of his recordings was "Still Alive at 75.
Still Alive at 75.
So are you and I.
Yeah. And he's kind of unusual in that his voice is a bass. In my awareness, there are not really many bass blues singers, but he is one of them.
Well, and Joe Williams wouldn't be bass. He was a baritone
I'd say bass baritone.
Yeah.
That's what I'd say about him.
Well, you used some terms that I was not familiar with when you first started listening to. You talk about records. We knew about, LPs, although you started out with 78s, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. What are cutouts? You used to talk about buying cutouts.
Yeah. A cutout is an album that a company is no longer actively selling, and they more or less dump them on the market by defacing the cover, clipping the corner or putting a hole through the middle of it and sending it to retailers who will therefore sell the now antiquated product at a discounted rate. And when I was growing up, one could get these cutouts for about $2 a record.
Well, that's still kind of steep.
Well,
not
yes.
For an LP, man. That was cheap for an LP.
Well, he used to belong to the Columbia Record
yes,
Club,
indeed.
And I did too. But it seems to me that $3.95, $4.95 was the standard price for most LPs
back in the 70s, probably. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what it amounted to was about half price.
Yeah.
And even I, as a student, could afford to buy those at that time.
And what's a DJ copy? Is that?
A DJ copy is a copy that the company sends to a disc jockey in the hope that the disc jockey will promote it on the air.
So it's what, for example, I frequently will get a reviewer's copy of a book, which is not the finished one, but
yes.
one that I can then read and interview
yeah,
you on.
The same concept.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Who's your favorite artist?
Oh, gosh. You mean musical?
Yes.
Jazz?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know that I have one. People have often asked me my favorite pianist, and why they ask that question, I don't know. But my answer is always Thelonious Monk, and maybe he's my favorite musician. I don't know.
Okay.
And he's kind of, it's kind of maybe an odd choice because it took forever for him to be recognized for the kind of musical genius he was, both as a composer and as a pianist. He played unconventionally. I mean, his fingers were flat, for example, when he played the keys. His dissonance is really appealing to me. But there are so many. Charles Mingus, Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Don Byas, Dexter Gordon. I mean, the list goes on. I love all those musicians.
Well, since you're mentioning those musicians, mention some of the songs that they covered so our listeners might tune into that.
Oh, well, I mean, somebody like Coleman Hawkins, for example, made a masterful recording of Body and Soul. There's a litany of bebop tunes, many written by Dizzy Gillespie, a South Carolinian, called Groovin' High, Salt Peanuts. Johnny Smith and Stan Getz had a beautiful recording of Moonlight in Vermont. Walter, the list goes on and on and on.
You're talking about Thelonious Monk. Maybe one of the best known of those is Round Midnight.
Round Midnight. Yeah, they even made a movie with that title.
Well, I look at some of the titles that you listed. It's a history of American music that's passed from one genre to the other. Autumn Leaves.
Sure.
Canadian Sunset, which was originally a very traditional instrumental.
Yeah, but that was made popular by someone who was a jazz pianist, Eddie Hayward, and was really popular in the 1950s.
Yeah. Fly Me to the Moon, I Left My Heart in San Francisco, and then even Jingle Bells. And we're not talking about that horrible Jingle Bell Rock.
No.
But, you know, that's one of the wonderful things about the holiday season for me is there are so many jazz musicians who decided to do a Christmas album or two along the way, and they bring in some great players to play with them, and yes, Christmas carols can swing.
Yes, and one was It Came Upon the Midnight Clear, and that was recorded by Billy Harper.
Not sure I'm familiar with Billy Harper off the top of my head.
Tenor saxophonist.
Oh, okay.
And there's a group called the Harper Brothers with him and Philip Harper.
You mentioned, with the exception of It Came Upon the Midnight Clear, he had composed everything else that was on that.
Yeah, that's not unusual. Yeah. I mean, there are all kinds of approaches to Christmas, for example. Lionel Hampton in the 1930s or 1940s performed a tune called Gin for Christmas. And you get off the beaten track, which is a fantastic solo by the trumpeter Ziggy Elman. And one of the sad things in jazz is the very last recording of the great Louis Armstrong, where he recited a Christmas carol. I mean, he just spoke it. And it is so sad that he is just reading this thing. And it's pathetic is what it amounts to. And a really sad ending to one of the great musical careers in American history. a singer who is generally considered a jazz singer is Mel Torme.
Yeah.
Who wrote Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire, called The Christmas Song, which has been performed by innumerable musicians, including jazz ones, including somebody like Dexter Gordon, for example.
Yeah. When you mention that song, I think about Tony Bennett. He's not a crooner like Bing Crosby. What would you call his genre? If
pop.
Yeah, pop.
Pop.
Although he did in his later years turn out some really fine, sensitive singing, you know, that kind of bordered on jazz, I guess. Ben, would you say that?
I don't know that, but I do know that he recorded two albums with the Count Basie Band.
Yes.
He also recorded an album with a bunch of drummers like Candido, for example.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly had a feeling for jazz. Frank Sinatra called Tony Bennett the greatest of all saloon singers.
Maybe that's what
I was trying. That's a great term for him, a saloon singer.
So where do you put Sinatra?
Well, at the very apex, very top. I don't know what really a jazz singer is, but if you ask my opinion as of the two greatest vocalists, pop jazz vocalists in history, I would say for male, it would be Frank Sinatra. I'd say female, Ella Fitzgerald.
Hear, hear.
But it's kind of silly because there are so many great singers, great musicians. To say this one is the best, there's no best. It's just a matter of taste. But that's mine.
And you're talking about people who sang pop, for instance, Rosemary Clooney, right? In her latter part of her life, she did a lot of great jazz recordings for Concord Records, yes. And we had the good fortune to have her on Main Street in Columbia toward the end of her life singing jazz with great bebop musicians.
That event, Main Street Jazz, or Jazz on Main, as it also was called, and you emceed one of them, as I recall, Alfred. Anyone who performed at that had absolutely world-class backing because Baron Malonis, the man who put that all together and financed it, insisted on bringing what were, to his way of thinking, the greatest musicians who are playing in what might be called the bebop tradition. Mm-hmm. Red Rodney, for example. And that's where Red Rodney, for example, met young Chris Potter,
indeed,
who went on to become one of the foremost tenor saxophonists of his generation.
Yep. And I believe that jazz came back to Main Street this year with the Cola Jazz folks. They indeed have had jazz on Main Street. It was back.
Yeah, that whole organization is really putting
fantastic
on performances and has an educational function as well under the directorship of the trumpeter Mark Rapp.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Ben, you and I are both retired from the Academy, but you have stayed very busy. This book, and I understand you've got another one in process.
It's a follow-up to this one. The book to which you're referring and about which we're speaking now is a collection of my reviews of recordings, both released on albums and CDs. The next one will collect my reviews of books, live performances, and include the essays that I've written about jazz over the years, and I expect that to be published by year's end. So throughout my career, I've had this kind of collateral interest in jazz. It never interfered with my more scholarly academic research, but it's just something I kind of did on the side. And lo and behold, I started collecting it, and they're 200-300-page books. So good for me.
Yes, very, very good for you.
Good for us.
Yes. And before we sign off today, what would you tell our listeners that you'd like them to remember about jazz?
It's vital. It's alive. It pushes boundaries. It's melodic. It's harmonic. It's rhythmic. Give it a try if you haven't tried it. Start with somebody like Louis Armstrong, by which I don't mean his Hello, Dolly and his more popular things late in life, but rather I would recommend starting at the beginning with the first fantastic recordings he made with his groups called the Hot Five and the Hot Seven. such as West End Blues, Potato Head Blues, Weatherbird, and then work your way up. He influenced this generation of musicians. Then you get into Duke Ellington, and it just goes on up to Charlie Parker, Ornette Coleman, up to the present. It's a matter of taste. What do you like? But in order to know what you like, you got to listen. And that's my recommendation. Start listening.
Mm-hmm. And in your introduction, there are a couple of sentences I want to read because they grabbed my attention. You say, part of the reason jazz appeals to me is that in swinging, much if not most of jazz swings, it drives forward, carrying the listener with it beat by beat. In this sense, it is both optimistic and life-affirming. You also view jazz as a most elusive and miraculous art, and improvisation in composition real time. While composition might be understood as improvisation without time constraint, jazz is breaking out its freedom.
On the moment, the superior musicians really have to create something meaningful without plan. I mean, what you play the melody of the tune typically, and then it's time to improvise on it. And what the musicians play at that point is determined on the spur of the moment. I mean, they really don't plan out typically what they're going to play. To me, that's miraculous. The melody stops. What happens next? I don't know. It is beyond me. It is miraculous. That's my word for it.
Well, Ben Franklin, the author of The Miraculous Art of Jazz, One Writer's Reviews, thank you for once again being with us on The Journal.
Walter, thank you for having me, and Alfred, too.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation today. I know that I did. It's always fun to talk with Ben Franklin about jazz and blues music. His love for these genres shines through, and the reviews he has collected in The Miraculous Art of Jazz are as vital and important as ever for listeners new to jazz, as well as longtime listeners who want to take a deeper dive into the music.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. I'm Alfred Turner, and I produce the show, which is made possible by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. Remember, the views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio or its underwriters.
New episodes of Walter Edgar's Journal are published on the first and third Fridays of the month, and are available at southcarolinapublicradio.org, on the SCETV app, as well as from your favorite podcast provider. We'll talk again soon.